Hi, it's Mountain Edition. All the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Zoe Rome, and I'm excited to be here with Wyatt.
Hi, Zoe.
Wyatt, it's been a big week in the valley. Snow fell in the highlands, and people are starting to look ahead to winter.
Wow.
Yeah, Aspen Ski Company wants to add even more snowmaking at Snowmass.
An online survey asks people from Aspen to parachute about what their housing needs are.
And scientists think that a tiny animal, the pika, may provide clues to what climate change will mean for the Rocky Mountains.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
An online survey looking to gauge the Roaring Fork Valley's housing needs is closing soon. Residents throughout Pitkin, Eagle, and Garfield counties are invited to participate. According to David Schwartz of Economic and Planning Systems, the company analyzing the results, the survey seeks to put a face to the problem of affordable housing in the Roaring Fork Valley. Schwartz says the study's primary goal is to steer the community towards a regional authority by providing data that shows that affordable housing isn't an isolated issue. It's valley-wide. It will evaluate the feasibility of a regional housing authority, what that might look like, and where potential funding would come from.
For nearly a decade, biologists with the nonprofit Rocky Mountain Wild and the Denver Zoo have studied pikas on the Front Range. This summer, that work is expanding to the White River National Forest. They want to know how a warming climate will impact the alpine ecosystem and are hoping pikas can provide some clues. It's a citizen science research project. Reporter Elizabeth Stewart-Severy joined the researchers on Independence Pass and brings us this report.
Pikas are pretty distinctive.
They look like a potato with Mickey Mouse ears and no visible tail, and they're just adorable.
Megan Mueller is a conservation biologist with Rocky Mountain Wild and co-director of their Front Range Pika Project, a decade-old study of the small mammals. Mueller coordinates field studies, and this year, those will include Independence Pass in the White River National Forest. Mueller is looking to record where pikas are now living, so she leads the way off-trail into a stretch of talus, a field of jagged, large rocks.
So the best place to look for them is underneath kind of the largest rocks in the rock field, kind of along the edge.
We scramble over large boulders along the side of a meadow.
There was the pika.
This squeaky chew toy sound is clear evidence that pikas are living in this talus field, and we pause to see if we can spot them. These are also the first steps for citizen scientists who will be participating in the project. Volunteers will trek to some key sites, note if pikas are present, and then record information about the habitat.
How big are the rocks? How close is the vegetation in the meadow? What kind of vegetation is it? How deep are the crevices under the talus?
I think if Independence Pass were to have a mascot, it would be the pika.
Karen Teague is executive director of the Independence Pass Foundation, which is working with Rocky Mountain Wild to mobilize volunteer scientists. Even though pikas have been abundant in places like this, scientists have seen their decline in other parts of the West, including southern Utah and parts of Nevada. Mueller explains that this raises concerns.
Pikas are an indicator of the health of alpine ecosystems because they're so sensitive to changes in temperature and snowpack and vegetation.
That's because of pika's unique biology, which is suited to cold climates. They have a high body temperature, a fast metabolism, and a thick coat that retains heat. They also seek out talus fields because the crevices under these large rocks are much warmer than the surface in the winter, especially when insulated by snow. And surviving through the winter takes a lot of planning and work. Mueller says pikas stash an average of 69 pounds of grasses, wildflowers, and shrubs in what scientists call a hay pile.
Isn't that amazing? And that's about 14,000 trips from their territory out to the meadow to get hay and back.
They're working really hard all summer, and as temperatures warm, it can be deadly for pikas. The same talus that keeps them warm in the winter provides shade and respite from the summer heat. And they need that time to rest in the shade. Their bodies can only warm an additional 2 or 3 degrees.
If they're exposed to temperatures above about 80 degrees Fahrenheit for a long period of time when they can't get under the talus and cool off, they'll die.
So the warming climate poses a serious threat, and the data Rocky Mountain Wild gathers about pikas will provide information on a changing ecosystem. For example, because pikas depend on snow for insulation in the winter, if that snow melts earlier in the spring, when temperatures are still very cold at night, they might not survive. So a decline in pika populations could indicate trends about everything from snowmelt to water supply to threats to other species, like Canada lynx, that also depend on a deep snowpack. Karen Teague says this chance to contribute to a growing knowledge base is why she's volunteering for the research project.
It's just yet another indicator of what climate change is bringing to a place that we love and care about.
Ultimately, Teague says, this project is about gaining firsthand experience with the realities of a changing natural world, and that goes beyond one species.
I think what we're doing is creating a greater understanding of the animal, greater intimacy with the landscape, and that's how we create great stewards.
Volunteer spots for this year are still open, and Mueller says they'll be back again next summer, too. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Zoe Rome.
And I'm Wyatt Orm. And Zoe, listeners tuning into Mountain Edition obviously want to stay in the know about local news.
Absolutely, and they can also stay on top of what's happening with Aspen Public Radio and throughout the community by liking our Facebook page and following us on Twitter at Aspen Pub Radio.
On our Facebook page, you can interact with our station through comments on our posts or by messaging us directly.
Aspen Public Radio invites you to dive into our news reports through our Instagram account. Follow Aspen Public Radio on Instagram to see our reporters out in the field, photos of our station guests, and a celebration of life in the valley. We want to see your photos too. Tag us or use the hashtag APRNews to be a part of the conversation.
All land managers in Colorado are tasked with preventing or managing invasive weeds. For the past 3 years, the Roaring Fork Transportation Authority has employed a herd of goats to eat weeds along the Rio Grande Trail. Elizabeth Stewart Severy brings us this report on their progress.
About 450 goats are now working to manage the weeds that grow along the stretch of the Rio Grande from Glenwood Springs to Emma. Brett Meredith is trails coordinator for RAFTA. He says there are three main goals in bringing the goats to the Roaring Fork Valley. First, they're meant to control invasive weeds. Goats eat just about anything, including all of the species on Colorado's noxious weed list. Second is to improve soil health. And finally, Meredith says, RAFTA wants to educate the public about invasive weeds.
You know, the goats are much more approachable than someone walking around spraying chemicals.
Meredith works ahead of the goats, spreading the seeds of native species. Then when goats come through and eat the weeds, they also till the soil with their hooves and fertilize as they go. He's collecting soil samples, but those haven't yet been analyzed. Still, Meredith says the project has been a success.
And they definitely are eating the noxious weeds. We're definitely getting out a lot of native seed ahead of them. They're fertilizing, aerating.
This year, there are two herds working in separate spots along the trail for a little more than a month. They eat about an acre daily. This is the third year that RAFTA has used goats rather than herbicides along the Rio Grande, and Meredith says he's hoping to continue the contract with Goat Green LLC. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
The U.S. Forest Service released its final analysis of the soil area that burned in the Lake Christine fire. As Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports, the impacts are most significant on the northern part of the burn area.
After wildfires, the U.S. Forest Service analyzes the damage caused to the soil. Severely burned soil can lead to erosion, debris flows, and flooding. The final analysis shows that the conifer vegetation near Mill Creek and Cattle Creek held high temperatures of heat for long periods of time as the Lake Christine fire burned, and that damaged soils in the area. 72% of the northern portion of the fire saw moderate or high burn severity. Officials warned that storms could cause flooding and mudslides near Upper Cattle Creek Road and Basalt Mountain Road. The report includes recommendations like improving drainage on roads and trails and closing some key areas. Scientists also suggest monitoring streams and working to treat and prevent noxious weeds from taking root in the vulnerable soil. Officials say it will take years for this portion of Basalt Mountain to fully recover from the burn, but new vegetation is already growing. Basalt Mountain and Upper Cattle Creek roads and trails in that area remain closed. There are ongoing firefighting operations and dangers from falling dead trees. District Ranger Karen Schroyer says the Forest Service will consider reopening these roads and trails next spring. The Lake Christine fire has burned about 12,500 acres and is 90% contained. The Cache Creek and Cabin Lake fires continue to burn in the White River National Forest as well. Rainstorms in the past week have helped reduce that fire activity. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
There's no shortage of opportunities to take beautiful photos in the Roaring Fork Valley. But as arts and culture reporter Kristen Kay found, some local photographers don't settle for just capturing pretty pictures. Conservation photographers want their images to tell an honest story about the changing environment around us.
Jeremy Swanson has been a photographer for the Aspen Skiing Company for the past 10 years. But today, he's not shooting people skiing through trees in waist-deep powder.
So we're in snowmass, up on top of the rim trail, looking towards the classic view of Daly, Capitol Peak, off in the distance. I'm just getting some shots.
Today is not the kind of picture-perfect day you would see on a Colorado postcard. The gray peaks in the distance are nearly camouflaged by the smoky air. But that's why Swanson is here.
Today's a great day to do it because it's not perfect. We have a bunch of haze, probably due to the wildfires, whether it's Lake Christine or the fires in California. So it's different, but it's honest.
For Swanson, these kinds of honest photos of the environment around us are powerful because of their immediacy.
It's easy enough to go to like the Pitkin County website and find out what the particulate matter was for that day or what the air quality looked like. But if you see a picture, it becomes instantly vivid that the wildfires that are happening around us, the changes that are happening in our environment and our climate, have a concrete impact even for those who aren't directly in the line.
Any photographer wants to capture beauty, but conservation photography looks to tell a more complete story.
We try to show things within their universe.
Susan Norton is the executive director of the International League of Conservation Photographers. She says that the label conservation photography really started being used about 15 years ago.
The term started being used to mean that you were devoting your work to not just taking images of wildlife or landscapes, but that then the work was being used for outreach, education.
If conservation photography is going to educate or even inspire action, Norton says, it's not enough just to take the photo. The written word becomes important, too.
If they provide a detailed caption that tells you, you know, what the conservation message is, we find that there's so much more engagement.
And how to increase engagement? That's a huge issue for conservation photographers. We're saturated with pictures every time we open our phones. How do you make an image stand out? Swanson says it's something he wrestles with in his work.
You know, you're going to have a lot less traction on the shot that doesn't show kind of the beautiful postcard view. But it's still important to try and make sure I get those photos so that it's not just that sort of rose-colored glasses view.
Photojournalist Pete McBride lives in the Roaring Fork Valley. He's documented environmental threats to the Colorado River and the Grand Canyon. He says that what sets a photo apart in this sea of imagery is an important story.
First, you have to find a story that you believe in, then you try to partner it with an image that helps tell that story.
McBride points out that while we're seeing more and more photos every day, we're getting talked at more, too. And so he aims to show, not tell.
You can actually make people feel like they see it and they experience on their own terms instead of being told what to think.
Even though he's documenting drastic, worrisome environmental changes, McBride says he's always still trying to get the most beautiful image he can.
If it's the end of the Colorado River and it's a cracked wasteland, I still want to make a beautiful image of it to stop people to make them pause and look at it. And then if that pause enables them to read the caption and then learn that the Colorado River runs dry, which few people realize, then I think that the photograph is doing its job.
Jeremy Swanson hopes that kind of education that conservation photography can provide will inspire people to take action.
In the end, we will only conserve what we love, we will only love what we understand, and we will only understand what we are taught. And Baba Diom said that, who is a Senegalese conservationist.
These photos he's taking on this hazy summer morning might not be shown on a website trying to attract visitors to the Roaring Fork Valley. They look to tell a more complex story about the changing wilderness around us. Kristen Kay, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
The Arts and Culture Desk at Aspen Public Radio is funded by the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation with a mission to support the arts, community, and outreach.
The U.S. Forest Service is conducting restoration work on Smuggler Mountain near Warren Lakes for the next several weeks. As Elizabeth Stewart-Severy reports, hikers and bikers could see increased traffic on the county road.
The Forest Service will remove an abandoned cabin, clean up trash and debris, and maintain a stretch of road on the upper portion of Smuggler Mountain. They're partnering with the Department of Corrections, and inmate crews from the Buena Vista Correctional Facility will assist in this project. It's part of an effort that began last summer, in which the Forest Service is working to remove 8 unauthorized structures in the White River National Forest. The others were located on Snowmass Mountain, Conundrum Creek, Anderson Lakes, and Lincoln Creek. This final project on Smuggler Mountain will impact about 3 miles from the county road to Warren Lakes. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
The town of Basalt and Eagle County have a strained relationship stemming from the county approving developments just outside of the town limits. At a work session on Tuesday, the two governments considered a possible remedy. So what would this remedy look like?
Well, they heard from the town of Estes Park, which could serve as a model going forward. Randy Hunt, who's the community development director for Estes Park, presented at the meeting, and he talked about the unique relationship that Estes Park has with the county that it sits in, which is Larimer County. Instead of the town and county having their own respective zoning, in the 1990s, they decided to draw a new boundary, which included the town and parts of the county that are just outside of the town. The town and the county together worked out what appropriate development should look like. They defined what are called zoning districts, basically what kind of buildings can go where, how many of them, and so forth.
If Eagle and Basalt used a similar model, what would the advantages be?
Well, it's supposed to eliminate what's called jurisdiction shopping, and that's where a developer looks at the town's zoning requirements and then the county's, and they say, we don't really like the town's requirements, so let's go with the county. This happens again and again, and suddenly a lot of development is happening outside of the town, often much to the town's chagrin. So the idea is to create more uniformity in a particular area instead of the line between a town and a county being a line basically between two very different sets of rules.
So what was the mood in the room like? Were people intrigued?
Yeah, they were. But this is really just food for thought. Randy Hunt, the presenter from Estes Park, said that developing a partnership like this takes a lot of time. You need to get everything right. But yeah, ultimately, if a system like this were in place, it would give Basalt more say over what happens just outside its boundaries.
Does Basalt currently have no say over what the county approves or denies?
No, they don't. They can urge the county one way or the other, but they don't have any jurisdiction, obviously. And a partnership like this would give them that. It would give them jurisdiction, which they'd share with the county.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Zoe Rome.
And I'm Wyatt Orme. Eagle County approved the Tree Farm Metro District, which advanced the controversial development in the Mid-Valley.
And the city of Aspen implemented Stage 2 water restrictions for the first time in history. On Tuesday, the city held an open house to help the public understand what it means for residential and commercial water use. Those stories and more news are on our website now. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org.
Earlier this week, the state approved Xcel Energy's plan to close 2 coal-fired power plants. As Elizabeth Stewart-Severy reports, the move means more renewable energy for the state.
Xcel plans to retire 2 aging coal-fired power plants in Pueblo and invest $2.5 billion in clean energy, including wind and solar. Xcel provides electricity to 1.4 million customers statewide, including some in Carbondale and Glenwood Springs. The move was applauded by environmental groups and green energy advocates, including Aspen Skiing Company Vice President of Sustainability Auden Schendler.
This move, which will bring Colorado to 55% clean power by 2026, is nation, if not world leading. It may be one of the most significant climate victories in the country this year.
Much of the Roaring Fork Valley gets its electricity from Holy Cross Energy. CEO Brian Hannigan says it, too, is working on acquiring more renewable energy, and some of that will come from Xcel's plan.
The JAS Labor Day Experience returns to Snowmass this weekend. Sunday, American rock and roll band The Record Company takes the stage in front of a sold-out crowd. Arts and culture reporter Kristen Kay has more.
The Record Company might be relative newcomers to the rock scene. They just released their second album, All of This Life. But Chris Voss, the singer and guitarist for the group, says they're influenced by some of music's elder statesmen.
Muddy Waters, Johnny Hooker, early rock and roll, your Chuck Berry's, your Elvis Presley's, your Little Richard's, big fans of the Stones, Hendrix, and on down the line.
The group is the opener on Sunday, but Voss says the energy they put into their live shows stays with their audiences.
We just try to throw down with reckless abandon and have a really good time. It's about fun. It's about positivity.
The JAS Labor Day Experience starts tomorrow night and runs through Sunday. Other acts include Lionel Richie, Jack Johnson, and the Zac Brown Band. Kristen Kay, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
There are no contested races in Snowmass Village this fall. Candidates for mayor and city council are running unopposed for the first time in history. Mayor Marky Butler and council members Bob Serkis and Bill Madsen are rerunning this election cycle. Butler has faced opposition in the past two elections. All three incumbents were sworn into office in 2014. Election day is November 6th. The Aspen City Council decided to extend a contract with developer Mark Hunt to buy two buildings near City Hall. Allison Bektesh reports.
By extending the contract, the city also agreed to place a question to the voters, asking if city offices should move into the Hunt property or be built on Rio Grande Plaza. The original project to build the Rio Grande offices has been held up in court, but the litigants would agree to drop all lawsuits against the development as long as the choice is put to the voters. The council has scheduled a special meeting for September 4th to discuss the specific ballot language. Last night, they also approved two additional ballot questions for this fall's election.
Reporter Allison Bektesh, who is at the city council meeting this week, joins me now here in the studio. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Zoe.
So voters might get to select where city offices go. Isn't that what the group who sued the city has been asking for all along?
Yeah, this is quite the turnaround. Because the city has actively avoided going to the public with this twice, there was a group of locals who don't want offices built on Galena Plaza, that Rio Grande area that it's now the library, parking garage, Tasters, etc. And they got petitions from the public to put this matter to the ballot. The city found that the signatures were turned in too late and had issues with verifying all of them. So that has since gone to the courts. Additionally, the city could have obtained financing that would have helped pay for the new development, but the type of money they were looking for requires a public vote, and they didn't feel comfortable doing that, so they went with a more expensive financing option.
But now they're fine with the public vote, so what changed?
Well, for one, the lawsuits held up the development long enough that they got into this other contract with Mark Hunt to buy the buildings he owns on Hopkins and Galena, right next to where city's executive offices are now located. So now it's not a question of should we or shouldn't we get more space for the city, but instead it's should new offices happen in this place or this place? It's a little bit of a different question. Secondly, by placing this on the ballot, they have received agreements from Mark Hunt that he will extend the contract beyond its September 1st deadline, and from the litigants that they'll drop their current lawsuit no matter which option is chosen by the public.
So what exactly is being presented to the voters?
The exact ballot language will be discussed by council on Tuesday and needs to be finalized by the 7th, but will basically read, do you want new city offices in the Mark Hunt buildings or developed at Rio Grande? This is an advisory vote, so it doesn't have to go through, but there could be something where the city signs that they say they will go through with whichever way this vote goes. That didn't happen in a similar advisory vote about City Hall in 2016. At the meeting this week, many more people spoke in favor of the Mark Hunt option, or really they spoke against building on the plaza. They say they just don't want a new building. Mayor Steve Skadron pointed out that retail and commercial space downtown is already at such a premium. Is it fair for the government to move into what could or should be local businesses? So certainly if the vote was taken in the room this week, it would have gone to buying the building. We'll see what happens going into the election.
This summer, the Roaring Fork, Frying Pan, and Crystal Rivers have all reached near historic lows, as low as 30% of average flow. This has many, from anglers to ecologists, concerned for trout. As the West becomes increasingly drought-prone and the climate continues to warm, fishermen and conservation groups are working together to protect the valley's fish. That's the Roaring Fork River. What is usually a consistent flow has slowed to a trickle this summer. The river lays sluggish in shallow beds like tide pools. Smooth, round river stones that were once completely submerged lie baking in the midday sun. This has been a problem, especially for fishermen.
This is the worst that I've seen in the years that I lived here.
That's Ashley Allen. He's lived in the valley for 39 years. He's the lead guide at Aspen Trout Guides, a fly fishing service located in downtown Aspen. Low water is rough on the brown and rainbow trout that live in the Roaring Fork's usually cool and clear waters. Liza Mitchell is an avid angler who works for the Roaring Fork Conservancy, an organization that monitors river levels.
If the temperature starts to increase, which happens when the water levels drop, then there's less oxygen available for them, and they get physiologically stressed.
Warm water holds less oxygen, and that makes it hard for fish to breathe. That just compounds the stress of being caught. Fishing in the valley is all catch and release, but the fish will put up a fight no matter what. Allen puts it like this.
Kind of the equivalent of you running a marathon and then going in a sauna to catch your breath. And the fish are just not able to recover.
Warm water raises the trout's metabolism so that they use more energy and need to rest more and eat more, even when less food is available. Low levels mean there's also just less habitat for trout, less rocks and eddies where they can hide out and snack on bugs. In an area like the Roaring Fork Valley, ecology is tightly tied to the economy. Some guiding services have seen a slight drop in business this summer because of the drought and concerns over fish, but guiding services have also been leading the charge in protecting trout. As Allen says,
we don't want to kill our business partners.
This summer, the Roaring Fork Conservancy worked with guide companies and conservation organizations alike to implement voluntary fishing restrictions, like not fishing from 2 p.m. until midnight. The problem isn't the lack of trout.
The fish are there, but we just have to take better care at handling the fish so that we don't overstress them.
The Roaring Fork Conservancy is looking to anglers for help maintaining stream temperatures. They've launched the Hot Spots for Trout Citizen Science Initiative to keep an eye on warming waters. They're arming anglers with thermometers to collect stream data. That information will be used to identify which areas are most impacted by warming water. Colorado Parks and Wildlife recommends anglers quit fishing when the water reaches 67 degrees. This year's low flows are a direct result of low snowpack. And according to Mitchell, this year is part of a larger pattern.
You know, mostly from climate scientists and from, you know, personal anecdotal experience, it is getting drier. This is a bad year and a trend towards more arid climate.
And while that is cause for concern, Zane Kessler with the Colorado River District, a public water planning and policy agency, says it's not code red quite yet.
Certainly not in a state of panic, but it's a concern for all folks who use water on the western slope, and that's ultimately every one of us.
For now, anglers can still wade into what remains of the cool waters and cast a line, waiting for the trout to rise.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Zoe Rome. AspenPublicRadio.org is your one-stop shop for local, national, and world headlines. All of our on-air news stories are archived online so you never miss a newscast. You can stream or podcast shows like this one and NPR special reports, browse photo slideshows, and find supplemental links to further coverage. Go deeper, go to AspenPublicRadio.org.
Join us tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup, when host Allison Bektesh sits down with reporters from around the valley, including our own environmental reporter, Elizabeth Stewart Severy. They'll discuss this week's biggest stories, from impacts from the Lake Christine fire to Aspen's new city hall, and they'll take a deep dive into this week's headlines.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.